everyone. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. Only radio this time. We do video when we have the ability with the guest, of course. But today it's audio only. No problem. Just letting you know in case you're looking for the video version of the show. But redice.tv is the website where you can find more from and about us. And also, of course, at redicemembers.com. That's for our subscribers. Just want to say, by the way, a big thank you to everyone that has signed up and supported us. Made sure that we can continue. Do get aboard, folks. If you haven't, support what we do. Make sure that we can grow. This is the best thing that you can do to aid and help us in the ongoing growth process. So thank you so much for signing up, gals and guys. Our guest is Ryan Landry. He's a Midwestern family man born and raised in New England. When not working in the financial realm, he maintains the blog 28 Sherman and writes also every Sunday at Social Matter. His podcast is Why America Weekly. It's hosted by Social Matter as well. And we had Ryan with us last October 2016, you know, talking about why America and how history rhymes, as it were. We wanted to invite him back on the show now to actually talk about some of the recent developments, to underline further the left and right divide that we've seen on the streets of America, specifically, of course, with Antifa on one side and the, what should we call it, the anti-communist alliance, if you will, on the other. This is really a group of a conglomerate of different people from some more, you know, I guess just civic nationalist cucked to a certain extent, Trump supporters to full-fledged alt-right people. You have a tremendous mix among the other side of this, as it were. And of course, Berkeley has been at the center of this, as you know, but it's happened in other places as well. So Ryan, I wanted to get you on, as I said, back on the show again, and kind of talk a little bit about this, because it's just been a tremendous development since we spoke. I don't think it was that bad. And we've had, I don't know how many, not only Berkeley, we've had Seattle, we've had a number of other places that had just literally been set on fire. What's your take on all of this?
Well, first off, thank you for having me back on. But secondly, what has changed even just from 2016? In 2016, you had specific rallies where Trump supporters were attacked, and generally it was Trump going to California or to Chicago, like deep blue areas, and he would have a rally, and the left would feel emboldened, the police would be told to stand down, and they'd, you know, throw eggs, chase after supporters, get violent, throw rocks at them. What's happened now is the left has taken to any slight incursion into what they consider their territory. They're not just going to meet people to chant at them and yell at them. They're going to come looking for a fight. So the default assumption is that the left is going to fight. And as you mentioned, the Antifa will come with their black clad outfits and their little backpacks with their first aid kits or their weapons that they hide in them. And then on the other side, the striking development is that the right wing, or the civic nationalists, however you want to phrase it, they are also coming expecting a fight. So it's not simply a political get together and you're worried about, you know, something might happen. It's the expectation that there's going to be a fight. It's the planning that there's going to be a fight. And this is something that, once again, yes, Weimar saw. It also is a reflection that both sides that are out there, both the left and the right, feel that they're losing and feel energized by their street actions. Whether you're on the left and you're, you know, even though you control so many institutions of power, you see Trump, you see a GOP Congress, and, you know, they fret and they frown, and they get angry, and so they want to do something about it. And then on the right, you know, maybe they're a little upset. Maybe Trump's not doing everything they want. They still want to express themselves. They feel emboldened by Trump's election, and they go there. And they're also looking for a fight because it's the right wing definitely changed its image from, you know, doughy, fat evangelicals into more muscle union types finally came over to the right wing.
Right.
And so they're definitely flexing their muscles. And that is something that happened in Weimar as well, where the right, the far right and the far left would have parades, would have marches, would have rallies, and also go to disrupt the other side, to get into fights. And they did it because the great middle parties didn't have those rallies. They were much more bourgeois. And, you know, they just did, okay, what do the big interests want us to do? Okay, we'll do that. And they didn't feed red meat to the people who were starving the most.
I wanted to play a clip in a little bit here to kind of set the stage. We did go through some of this in the first show that we did, but I want to touch back on that because we're, as you've explained, we've entered into a new phase of this. So let's make sure we touch on the background of well, some of the similarities and the foundation to this as well. But who would you say then is, who is the Nazis? Is the Antifa that's the Nazis, or is it the, quote, Nazis that are the Nazis?
No, the Antifa are just straight up communists.
Right.
The right wingers that are out there are not Nazis. The right wingers that are out there are, I would say, more just straight up nationalists and patriots. Because you can still, as you mentioned, some of the cucked right showing up to those rallies for Trump. People like Based Stickman. He's definitely a more normie conservative. So,
yeah, he is definitely. So this is, it's very interesting. There's a lot of things happening in America right now with the removal of statues. We had a fight, if you will, the other day just in New Orleans. They're removing some of those. That's something I'm going to get into later as well. And what's happening with the deconstruction, basically, of America. But let's set the stage a little bit. Let's play a clip. It's about 5 minutes, but it's very good. It summarizes the situation before, the Second World War in Germany, in Weimar, the Weimar Republic, so that our audience can understand, both some of the similarities, but also some of the things that are not similar. So let's listen in on this first, and then we can comment. There's quite a bit to chew on in this one, but it's a good clip, so listen to this.
A handful of cities became legendary. Art, culture, and life itself burned brighter there. Flamed by a tolerance that allowed eroticism, permissiveness, and sin to flourish.
And this, by the way, is what I mentioned that before we continue. This, of course, is from a very positive perspective, that this is, they're selling this as the greatest thing ever. So yes. It's amazing.
Berlin was the place to take a walk on the wild side. The edge city in the 20s, more than any other place in the world. Unlike France, unlike the United States, Berlin lost. Germany lost in the First World War. With that loss came a revolution that swept away an entire political order.
After the armistice, the guns went silent across Europe. But not in Berlin, where Germans were fighting Germans. News of the loss by the Fatherland had come as a shock to Berliners. They had been told that they would be the victors. The old order had lied to them, and now the old order was gone. In its place came chaos. The streets of what was once a quiet, conservative town became free fire zones. The nationalists of the extreme right battling it out with the communists of the extreme left. And out of this struggle emerged a new democratic state, the Weimar Republic.
Everything was going upside down in Germany, and they never experienced a democracy. So I said, now that we have freedom, now we have a democracy. We should have no censorship, not in the theater, not in literature, and not in the cinema.
With this new anything-goes attitude, Berlin overnight replaced Paris as the center of hedonism.
The end of censorship was quite extraordinary for the whole world. That's why people saw Berlin as the Babylon of the 20s.
Berlin had embraced this extraordinary experiment in permissiveness with total abandon.
Things that had been considered to be immoral, amoral, whatever, were became irrelevant, and anything went.
With no censorship, the theaters of Berlin became exhibition halls for unashamed sensuality.
Berlin became a magnet that attracted the most important artists, architects, film directors, painters, writers of the era. They all came to Berlin to make careers and to try and contribute something, but they all found it irresistible.
For those fleeing the collapsed empires of Eastern Europe, Berlin was seen as a cosmopolitan haven, tolerant to outsiders. And joining this massive migration into the city were hundreds of thousands of Germans escaping a stultifying provincialism sweeping the rest of the country.
Berlin was basically the fighting ground of politics through culture. Every intellectual was leftish. The whole political right wing, which basically came from Munich, did not play any role in the beginning. The whole town was in the hands of leftish ideas.
But outside Berlin, the right-wing nationalist movement was attracting scores of disillusioned Germans, including one obscure Austrian corporal by the name of Adolf Hitler. Hitler, like many of the right-wingers, hated this new Berlin, a city bursting with Bolsheviks, socialists, revolutionaries, Slavs, and Jews.
By 1922, inflation was spiraling wildly out of control.
With virtually every currency in the world more valuable than the German mark, foreign tourists flocked into the city to take advantage of the cheapest sex on the continent.
You had tourists coming from all over the world. $10 in American money could buy you anything you wanted.
People were renting out their bodies, people that you wouldn't believe, like generals and their wives that couldn't have been terribly attractive, would engage in public sex in their living room if there was any Japanese, Turks, or Americans who would pay for it, who would pay a dollar for it.
With entire life savings disappearing through hyperinflation and desperate for hard currency, middle-class Berliners transformed their homes into houses of pleasure for tourists.
There was one family that actually turned this into quite a high art form, if you like, from a pornographic point of view. They started a little club called Alefa, which is an acronym in German for Alles einer Familie, which really means all in the family. And this was run by mum, dad, and two daughters, but it developed into a club where every possible sexual taste was catered for.
Hausfrauen became harlots, teenagers turned tricks, and Papa became a pimp.
But it wasn't just Berliners. It was tens and maybe hundreds of thousands of young boys and young girls who were coming to Berlin to participate in this hard currency sex traffic.
If you knew what to look for, you could find anything, anything known to man in the sexual world was available on the streets of Berlin.
On any given night, as many as 100,000 prostitutes walked the streets or worked the sex clubs across the city.
There were all different whores with different kinds of makeup on the street. For instance, one was called Mutzi. Mutzis who were prostitutes who hung out on just one street, Mutzstrasse, and these were pregnant prostitutes. And this being Germany, instead of just having pregnant prostitutes together, they were strung out on the street according to how pregnant that they were, so limousines stopping there could choose exactly how pregnant they wanted their Mutzi. There were prostitutes who looked horrible, who had acid-scarred faces or hunchbacks or were lame or crippled. These were called grasshoppers. You had mother and daughter teams on one street that dressed exactly alike.
Here in Berlin, sex for sale offered every sort of perversion or fetishism imaginable. There was not a sexual appetite that could not be satisfied in this city.
All right, so yeah, let's talk about the issues of, you know, prostitution and sex trade and the more kind of degenerate, sex that really took place there a bit later. I wanted to speak about the ongoing violence first. In the beginning, they explained this, that there was, you know, factions competing. It was primarily in Berlin. And then outside of that, you had, you know, more right-wing kind of group forming in opposition to all of this. And of course, you tend to understand when you look at documentaries like this and listen to what the situation was really like. It's like in this anything goes kind of climate, obviously, you're going to have people resenting this. One question that I had for you about this, Ryan, is, it sounds almost in the clip that this developed practically overnight. And I'm not sure if that's true, if this culture war was ongoing for a longer period of time. What do you know about this?
Well, that's a good question you bring up, because Berlin itself, they had people of that was where the idea of homosexuality as a identity and not just you engage in sodomy the idea of being a homosexual was developed. And Hirschfeld, I believe, was the sexologist that pushed it. And that was before 1918. And then once the Kaiser abdicated and the Weimar Republic started, you did see, as they mentioned, obscenity laws were pulled back. The abortion laws were reformed. I believe it was as late as 1927, prostitution was decriminalized. So it was an ongoing thing. It didn't happen right overnight, because as mentioned in that clip, you had all the street battles between the communists, which your listeners will know how in the Soviet Union there was, Trotsky wanted to export the revolution and Stalin didn't. And that's basically what was going on in Berlin, was they were trying to do a Soviet-style revolution in Germany, just like they had done in Russia in 1917. So, you had those battles, but, they are right that the city sucked in hundreds of thousands of young people because the economy was in the trash. So many young folks said, I can go to the city. I can, there's got to be some kind of work there. And if not, I already know somebody there. And then you had the absolute surplus of women because of all the deaths that Germany, deaths and maimings that German men were wiped out in World War I. And that clip, I think that clip is from a documentary series called Legendary Sin Cities.
Yeah, that's right.
And it talks about, because I think they go over Paris, Berlin, and Shanghai. And Berlin is kind of the superstar of that period because, as they mentioned, anything goes. Like, anything truly was out there. But, they had to have, because the hyperinflation didn't start until the early 20s. Now, folks, there was devastation, and there was the whole hammering out the Versailles Treaty. But there was, the economy still chugged along as they had to rebuild, and they did have industries going. Once, as they mentioned the middle class over and over again in that clip, once the middle class had their savings wiped out by the hyperinflation, you had a lot of people who had nothing to lose, and they had nothing. They had nothing to fall back on. So they had to look, in a way, how are they going to pull in money? And with the hyperinflations, as they mentioned, hard currency, you had to pull in foreign dollars. There was a book I read where it said this one family had gone to America and bought, had bought some American bonds. And the fact that they bought American bonds before the war is what allowed them to eat well during the Weimar Republic, because the American dollar was worth so much and held its value through the hyperinflation. But your middle class got wiped out that way, and your middle class in Germany, which was on a salaried basis and not paid hourly, not unionized, they couldn't argue, they couldn't fight, they couldn't strike, they couldn't push for salary increases as rapidly as their blue-collar brothers and sisters. And once your blue-collar folks, they could say, hey, prices are going up, I need more of a pay, I need more pay, they could actually strike and get something for it. The folks who were paid on a annual basis, with an annual salary, they didn't have that power. So you had that middle-class squeeze going on. And then on top of that, after the hyperinflation, their economy went through what they called rationalization. And rationalization was just becoming more efficient, more Americanized. That beautiful German craftsmanship. They said, we have to cut down costs. We have to get more efficient. So, they started to push on Germans of, okay, we don't need 12 men for this job. We now need 9. You had a lot of very well-paid, middle-aged, late, say 35 to 54-year-old men were being laid off. You also had young women who were entering the workforce, and young women were cheaper. They were cheaper employees. So you had a lot of pressure on the white-collar wages to keep them down. And by doing that, you had a lot of people who became desperate, and then they would say, okay, how do I eat, sell myself? And then some of the others would say, I'm desperate. I'm going to go to political rallies. I'm going to listen to what these politicians are saying. You have nothing to lose. you know, you'll take a swing at some, you know, you'll take a swing at somebody with a baseball bat.
Yeah, exactly. It's the only way to make some sense of things, get some of that frustration out. Yep. So what happens when you, is this what happens when you have no censorship, not in theater, in cinema, in books, everything, anything goes? And I always wonder why it goes then in that direction. I mean, I understand the idea of if there's inhibitions and they are released, maybe there's even overcompensation to a certain extent to go in the opposite direction of trying to almost prove how far you can go or something like that. I understand that this was maybe for an economic reason as well. That was a factor here. But obviously this idea of no censorship is, I mean, there has to be restrictions, right? What do you feel about this?
Yeah, I think there's also an element of the artist themselves. You know, not everybody's a talented artist. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say I'm a great playwright and I'm a great painter. I'm not. But there are enough people who could do something crass on stage for a laugh. And anybody can, you know, do something degrading if they're willing to. And that's how they differentiate themselves. And, you know, as is the case, say, in even with modern pornography in Europe and America, you know, the first time somebody does this act, you know, and then people wait for that next time that person's going to do the first, you know, act that's maybe a step further, a step more degrading. You start doing it not just for shock value, but because that's the only thing you're bringing to the table. And I think on top of that, a lot of the owners of those small theaters, you know, the burlesque clubs, the theaters, even taverns that just had a stage, you know, they were willing to do it to pack a bar, to pack a theater, to then sell them alcohol. Because, I mean, that's where they were really going to make their money. You know, so they were just doing it to pull people in. And so you put something on the marquee that's completely out there. And if you're a place that always offers something that's completely out there, you're always going to get seats. You know, you're always going to get people's asses in the seats.
Right. So there's a number of things here which are interesting and compare, if we compare them. But before we go there, let me ask you, do you think that, you know, what they describe here in the documentary, is this where the modern left want things to go? Do you think that this is, in their view, this is like the most beautiful thing you can achieve by letting all inhibitions go?
Yeah, I think that for the elite in the left, it's the ultimate sales pitch. It's, you know, offering people full liberation and that they will not be shamed at all for anything they do. And by not shaming anyone for anything they do, everybody's little kink gets looked over. You know, it's like, oh, okay, it's all right if you have a balloon fetish, or it's right if you have a foot fetish. Oh, it's okay. Everything's okay here. They think that if everybody feels liberated that way, everybody will be happy. They'll pacify people. Even if they can't give them the standard of living that they had before, they can still get them with their kink.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, today we have people, you know, kind of pushing the envelope in different ways too. They, I don't know, they bleed on something or they go up and pee on stage. You know, you have those kinds of, you know, in attention seekers, basically, that they manage to pull it off. But you have another aspect to this as well, like we saw the other day with Bill Nye, which kind of, for me, takes it back into that realm of pushing these things, of beginning the process of selling this and pitching this to kids. And actually, I want to watch this clip too, or listen to it for those few that might not have come across it yet. And I want to get your take on it too, Ryan. But let's just listen to this here. The Rachel Bloom is it that does this song. So check this out.
Girlfriend, please give it up for Rachel Bloom.
World of ours is full of choice, but must I choose between only John or Joyce? All my options only, hard or moist. My vagina has its own voice, not vocal cords, a metaphorical voice. Sometimes I do a voice for my vagina. Please don't tell me I'm the only one who does that. Cause my sex junk is so much more than either power bottom or a top off. Versatile love may have some butt stuff. It's evolution, ain't nothing new. There's nothing taboo about a sex too. just add salt or Gerard Depardieu. French treasure. Cause my sex joke is for much more than either if they're alive, I'll date them. Channing or Janet Tatum, I'm down for anything. Don't box in my box. Give someone new a handy, then give yourself props.
Oh, you think you're so smart. Did you learn gay in college?
Here with all of that while I drop some knowledge.
All right, you get the idea, people. God almighty, you know,
that was terrible rap. That is embarrassing. Too. That was terrible rap.
Yes, oh. I mean, it's so embarrassing. I feel embarrassed and ashamed watching this stuff. And they say, I love the line too, if they are alive, I'll date them. I guess that will begin to change soon as well. So I think the difference though, maybe, I'm not sure, maybe you know about this, but isn't the difference that they're also selling this as objective science now? That's pretty an interesting angle to it, where basically having, what's the line? Sex stew is somehow evolution, right?
Yeah, it's the politicization of science now in a gender realm. I mean, you know, to be XX or XY is like, you know, 99.6% or 99.7% of all humanity. You know, the people who are actually XXY or XYY, you know, odd chromosomal combinations, they're so rare. And what Nye, if I recall correctly, seeing the clip from that, is he was trying to say that, you know, gender's on a spectrum. Well, no, not it's not. There's two slots that 99.9% of people fall into. Then there's this tiny sliver that some other folks fall into. There's no spectrum. And so it's trying to use science to back up the academia and this, you know, the humanities pitch of gender fluid and all that garbage. I've seen the clip. I don't know exactly what gender the person is who was singing or rapping that. It's terrible. And the fact that they're using Bill Nye, who formerly was associated with teaching children about science 20 years ago, it's a bit of a, it's a bit of a poisonous use of somebody associated with children's stuff. And right. Even though it's probably really just going to affirm a 20 to 30 year old who hates themselves and hates their dad even more, even though that sketch is really just going to affirm a 24 year old who says they're gender fluid, it's poisonous that it's Bill Nye, even just, you know, an actor, but Bill Nye standing up there and going, hey, this is, you know, science is telling you this, so you got to believe it, because after all, the left, you know, the left prays to science; it doesn't pray to God.
That's right.
It's sad to see Bill Nye do that, because his career was in an era where everything he said as Bill Nye the Science Guy, you know, a character, is on video. We have stills of it. We have video of him saying things that completely contradict what he's saying now in the service of progressives. So it's kind of like you see that terrible fall, you know, of an individual, where he's selling his soul just for what, a second act on television,
mm-hmm.
You know, a second act to his career. It's pathetic.
Yep. Dirty. I mean, you had, if you go back, of course, I forget, maybe this was in Paris and not Berlin, but you had, I think we brought up the Danish Girl, the movie last time, one of the doctors that performed the first sex change operation. And this was specifically, I think, going from male to female, Kurt Warnecross, I believe it was. But again, I couldn't confirm if this was in Berlin, but I think it was in Berlin. Do you remember?
No, I'm not certain.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty, I mean, that's interesting. So the ideas are not new. They try to pitch them even to a certain extent back then. I don't even know if they were as bad as they are today, though. What would you say?
Well, it's time out today compared to 20s or...
Yeah.
I would say that we are worse today. You know, the Germans, whatnot, did it with cruder technology. We're worse today because we do reach down to pitch it to children, and we do incorporate like the alien third world. You know, Josephine Baker was dancing in Europe in the 20s and considered like an exotic. You know, she was an exotic, and it was very unusual. It's very taboo what she was dancing in. And some of her dances was simply just, you know, her in a bejeweled, bikini, shaking it on a stage. Something you kind of laugh at now going, oh, that was taboo. Well, that was risque. But for the time it was, and there was still considered, wow, how would you even cross that line to incorporate folks from, say, the third world? They also would not have been pitching it to children. Now, yes, there were child prostitutes in Berlin, in the Weimar Republic, but they weren't going to put it on, they didn't have television, but, you know, they weren't going to put it on radio or in the theaters and expect you to educate, you know, to use that as a propaganda piece for your kid. There was still a sense of, okay, it's for an audience of 16 plus, you know, for people who are mentally ready to talk about this. The fact that American media, whether it's NPR, Cosmo, any of those magazines or a news report, the fact that they'll talk about a four-year-old or a six-year-old becoming trans, or parents being so happy to embrace, you know, their daughter is not just a tomboy, she actually is a trans boy. The fact that we're doing it with kids, I would say, makes us worse. I mean, it's we have no limits.
Yeah, it's true. Was it I retweeted the other day? I think it was another article. Yeah, they were talking about that too, whether, here it is, Newsweek. Should surgeons perform irreversible genital surgery on children? The idea that this is even discussed, right, viable issue that should be discussed, shows how deep down the rabbit hole we've truly gone on this, right?
Yeah, 20 years ago, there was a, at my wife's college 20 years ago, they were going to bring a commencement speaker. And the commencement speaker was pro-trans and very big on the gender switching stuff. And what ended up happening was the administration said, no, we're blocking that speaker. This was just 20 years ago. And this was trans and trans for, you know, adults. 15 years ago, I remember when I was in college, there was a group of girls that I knew because of one lesbian I knew, that they had talked to this professor, and the professor had talked to them about, you know, gender's just in your head. Don't worry about it. Start going through the process. And these women were, you know, binding their breasts down. But the thing with them was, even though that professor had come and spoke at the college and said, you should do this, the psychiatrist and the doctor said, you know, live for 2 years as a man. You know, try to live as a man in your life for 2 years before you do any hormone therapy, before you get a mastectomy, you know, but before you do things you can't reverse. But nowadays, it seems like if a teenager, you know, expresses gender confusion, they're automatically doping them up within, you know, four or five visits to a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And that's going to change not just their body, but it's going to change their mind.
Definitely.
The testosterone or the estrogen, those kind of injections are going to mess with their mind.
Yeah, it is. And they're, of course, lifting many of these individuals out as great heroes. And a lot of people will do this just to get maybe attention and be on the same level. They say, oh, it's so hard. It's so difficult. And I'm not saying maybe on a personal level that it's difficult for them, considering maybe the disassociation between gender and the biology of your body, and then how your brain has developed. I believe that there is a schism there. But nonetheless, the fact that they go in the opposite direction, Ryan, and if it's a boy biologically, why not give him testosterone instead of estrogen and cutting his genitals off, right?
Bingo, yes. Why wouldn't you try to give him therapy to make him feel the gender he was born as? But there's actually even a schism, and I've heard this from gays, that there's a schism even within the gay community about all the focus and the attention trans has received. Because they look at trans as, first off, there's so few of them. But secondly, a lot of gays view the trans thing as a complete fashion fad. And that's similar to lesbians looking at the bisexual college female with skepticism and just kind of, they roll their eyes at them, or they show disgust with them. The idea of the trans people who are just, you know, they have gender confusion or they're gender fluid, gays are just as mad at them as well and just as annoyed by them because of the elevation that the media has given them.
Right. So we can pose this question of whether or not the left knows what they're doing in this regard by pushing these kinds of things. Will it have a counter reaction? When it does, which I believe it's happening right now, how severe is it going to be? They mentioned in the clip that immigration was an issue into Germany, but Berlin specifically. Of course, again, that was due to economic reasons. You could get so much for your money there, etc. But imagine, though, Ryan, that at the time it was mostly, not only, but mostly Europeans that were migrating in. And that was enough of an issue, enough of a problem at the time to create animosity. As we know, many of these multicultural states eventually kind of develop into a very authoritarian system. And if this contributed to the problem at the time, let's juxtapose that in terms of what's happening today with, as you said, the Third World being invited into the West while pushing these kinds of issues as well. Are we in for a even greater counter-reaction to this than even back then? What do you think?
I do think that the reaction to it will probably be greater just for what you're saying right there. The mix of cultures and people is so it's so remote. They're so alien to one another. Because as you mentioned, in the Weimar Republic, yes, they did pull in some folks from other Western European countries and America, but they also pulled in a lot of Slavs, Poles, and other folks who were from the Austro-Hungarian Empire that unraveled. They pulled in folks there who were desperate. And some of them, you know, were competitors economically. Some of them were exploiters. Some of them were refugees from what was going on in Russia with the Soviet Revolution. So, you know, there was a huge mix, but still there was a core European identity that those people had, that those people could share. What's going on now with pulling in people with, you know, with literally like an airplane goes, you know, vacuums up people from the Middle East or Africa and then just parachutes them down into some random, you know, little town in Germany.
Yeah.
That is completely different. That's almost monstrous to think of that process.
Yeah.
Compared to the clips from World War I and first after World War I, where people leave areas, you know, with a horse or a donkey and what's on their back.
Yeah, walking the distances.
Yeah. It's not some NGO picks you up and ferries you across the water, you know, and gives you a little pamphlet. Here's how to apply for benefits.
That's
here's
right.
Where to go. I mean, it's completely different. It's, you know, a mechanized, industrialized process.
The scarier part is the fact that the cause of it all is supposedly, you know, war and ruin. So one way to look at it is that the American Empire bombs a location, and then the bombing of the location becomes the justification for importing other people. Because there is that statistic that I think of all the refugees, only like 15 to 20% are actually coming from Syria.
Yeah.
The vast majority are coming from other countries, and that like one third of them are coming from sub-Sahara Africa, which last I knew, there was no gigantic war that was destroying those countries happening. I think actually in isn't it in Sweden where most of the crime has been committed now by Afghan immigrants, not even Syrian immigrants?
Yeah, it's Afghan, but there's Moroccan, street gangs, young kids. There is obviously it is an African element too. Don't know exactly which countries, but I know that Norway recently, they just went down to they're just like scouring against the Mediterranean Sea, bringing up over 500, you know, they call them migrants or refugees, but invaders from Nigeria that they dumped off in Italy here just like a week or so ago. So this is happening all the time. But yeah, to your point, we have a lot of problems with Afghani invaders too. They attack cops. There's no respect for anything. It's a huge problem. It hasn't even unfurled yet properly.
The disturbing conflict, because if a reaction is brewing, and yeah, I do believe one is, the disturbing portion of it is if you kind of look at the sides, it's almost like you have the childless, self-loathing Europeans and whites wanting to get rid of the reproducing whites and Europeans of their own country and hand their nations over to third world people that they invite. Because I know that somebody was making a point, the fact that Merkel and Macron and Theresa May, that they're all childless.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's kind of indicative of, you know, the elite, the white elites, especially the liberals who are in charge of these European countries, that they don't reproduce and they don't really have a thought for the future. So might as well just hand it over to the folks from the third world.
Yeah. It's incredibly worrying. And when you said mechanized process, you know, I was thinking the new term for it, I guess, is the military industrial replacement complex, right? We have from the Kalergis to the EU elite today that are, of course, advocating for this replacement process. It's like nothing we've seen before. I mean, with modern transportation, it becomes so much easier. And the refugees, as you said, 100 years ago is nothing like today, where, you know, the established welfare offices in the West stands ready to receive the burden of these people. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, and when you, it's, for me, that I always kind of have a laugh when online somebody will say, well, you know, the people travel distances in the past, or, you know, there were always so-and-so, there were always Africans in Europe going back 600 years. And it's like, well, how many were there?
Two, maybe.
You know, because an archaeologist, I had a friend who was an archaeology major, and he went into archaeology, and he said, just because you find one coin, you know, with the face of a Byzantine emperor, does not mean there was trade with the Byzantines in northern France. It just means that somebody had that coin.
Correct.
He said, you have to find more of them. And in established, you know, cities with merchants, and there has to be a trail to show that there actually was trade. You can't just find one little piece of evidence. It's not a murder scene. And that always stuck with me, because one thing that's forgotten is that with air travel, we forget how the Sahara Desert was such a border on its own, because it was so difficult to cross. And that basically made it so that, you know, the Roman world, North Africa, was white.
Yeah, that is correct. You know what? Let's take a short break here. I have much more I want to ask you about. I'm going to talk about, you know, you mentioned before rationalization, of course, of the workforce. We stand also in front of the threshold of that. I want to get into that. And also, of course, we had America entering into the First World War. Just a little over about 100 years ago now, and I want to get your take on what would happen if they stayed out of it. I want to get into the French election as well, and also all these statues that are attacked and being taken down now, primarily in the south, but I believe eventually they will come for the ones in the north as well. So let's get into that after a break in more detail, more time spent there. But Ryan, please tell us about Social Matter, 28 Sherman, and all the stuff that you do, so people who are new to your work can find more about it.
Social Matter is a group website that is geared for statecraft for an American restoration. And it's basically, how are you going to come up with ideas and execute on those ideas to properly run, you know, a nation, to properly run an empire? I mean, that is, we all live in the American empire right now. How would we operate it better? My home blog is 28 Sherman, and I post a couple of essays a week there, and then right now during the about a couple of essays a week at 28 Sherman, and then every Thursday I do usually take a photo from the Great War, from World War I, while it is the centennial of the Great War. I'm posting that each Thursday just to make sure it sticks in people's minds of the sacrifices made and what was fought.
Oh, that's good. People need to know that. It's very good that people get a reminder about what that was, what they fought for. And, you know, some people pointed out, you know, it was this cartoon. I've been looking for it, and I couldn't find it. It was just this one paneled cartoon, and it was like these old British people who'd fought in the Second World War, probably. The Second. And they said, you know, thank God that, you know, we beat the enemy, because otherwise today we would be speaking a foreign language while they're in London at a cenotaph, you know, talking about this. And then while surrounding them are all these foreigners, you know, speaking different languages while they're like blind to it. And I it was such a good cartoon, such a good panel, because it just encapsulated everything. Like, yeah, we had to protect ourselves. We could get invaded by all these other people without pretending it's not happening. But anyway, let's talk more about that and some other stuff in the second segment. So stay tuned, folks. RedIceMembers.com. Please go there. Sign up for a membership with us. That's really the best way to support us. And we thank you so much for your support. You make it possible for us to do what we do only with your support. So thank you so much. But yeah, we'll take a short break. We'll be back with Ryan Landry. Stay tuned.